Welcome to the Development Policy Centre. In this podcast entitled Coping with High Risk and Uncertainty in Aid Policy Design and Practice, you'll hear Professor Adam Ford talk on risk and uncertainty in development practice. In his talk, Professor Ford examines the theories of change that underpin project management techniques used by aid practitioners and argues that aid work could benefit from a re-evaluation of such theories of change. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
I have an ulterior motive for being here because my sister just generated my third niece, which is nice. So that's a good excuse. I've done three books sort of on method. There's a book called Coping with Facts, A Skeptic's Guide to the Problem of Development. There's a book called Understanding Development Economics. They both came out of teaching. This didn't. So my experience in performing this is not... This is the first time I've done a seminar on it. As Terence said, I'm primarily made my living as a development consultant aid practitioner. I started as an engineer and got master's and PhD degrees in economics. My main academic claim to fame is being a global expert on Vietnam, where I'm probably the most widely cited person. So I came to development practice as a country expert, speaking the language and all the rest of it, and also coming from an engineering rather than an astrophysics background. And in some ways, that explains my take on these issues. What had a big effect on me in my career was spending 2 years at National University of Singapore in 2000-2001 teaching, which allowed me to sit back and look at established beliefs. And this is about this book and some ideas and so on. It's a peculiar book in that it often produces, so as I can see from talking about the ideas, extreme hostility. It also produces a sort of relaxing sense of, yes. And one of the reviewers, the publisher's reviewer, said he hoped this, it was a pity this book wasn't published 50 years ago, as it would have saved a lot of time. So it's interesting. I was in Hanoi last week and met the head of one of the bilaterals, who was, as a practitioner, of course, my basic problem is dealing with the results-based management log frame that comes at me from the capital city, and I Mickey Mouse this in various ways. So that's the sort of stance I'm coming from. The book argues that an important issue in aid policy design and practice is how high risk and extreme uncertainty is best coped with. So I'm coming at it through that angle. And I think that by asserting the existence of predictive knowledge, the DAC required log frame approach assumes a known predictive cause-effect relationship, i.e. very low risk. And is this sort of stuff making sense to people? Okay. How present is this issue? And I think the data, what you can find out there, suggests a lot. Levine and Zervos, famous American Economic Review article, 1993, looked at data sets looking at relationships between cause and effect, explaining economic growth variation globally, and find there are almost no robust relationships. Bang. I got somebody to look at citations of these, and an article I got published in 2005 found that about 80% of the citations said, well, of course we know what causes growth. And I think that sort of thing is normal. And this implies that high risk is the norm, if you organise on the basis of known predictive cause-effect relationships. Because a lot of data suggests all they don't exist. And the research programme as a whole, all these articles, are publishable because of certain choice of proxies, and so on and so forth. If, to take another set of data, information that looks at the attitude towards the log frame approach amongst practitioners, such as INGOs, tends to report that it's imposed rather than spontaneously adopted. What they would like to happen is be given the money and get on with it, to generalise, and I tend to talk like that. This is a book. Again, this implies that high risk is the norm. Another one is that evidence for repeated evaluations of the same intervention don't tend to produce convergence. There's a guy called Tilly who did some, I can quote on that. Standard, you run your log frame, ex post, you evaluate it. If you do a repeated evaluation using a different consultant, unless you fix it through the TOR, it'll get a different answer. you don't get convergence. So those are three empirics that suggest that we're dealing with quite a lot of risk. Humans can be argued to be well used to unpredictability. Jokes, practices, Australian climate, blah, blah, blah. Right? So the main issue is then the risks involved in organising on the assumption that the context is predictive, when it would be better to assume not. So the book sets itself up as being a comparison between assume the context is predictive, assume it's not, and how you manage that. So coping with high risk, high uncertainty, in many ways, comes down to being able to organise as though the context is, call it, chaotic. Okay. The article I published, 2016, looks at the aspects of interventions in Cambodia in these terms, as a case study of where apparently superior Western capacity did not lead to desired outcomes. Multiple truths, each organising as though the world is predictable, are rather easy to beat. Or to put it in rugby union terms, why the French and the Welsh used to beat the English. Why might the world appear unpredictable? Candidates for explanation. One, technical word, technical phrase, lacking ontological stability. GDP here and not now is not the same as GDP there and then. In natural science terms, this would mean that a rock on Mars is different from a rock here. Whether it is or isn't is an empirical issue. Lack of epistemological stability. Causal relations here and now are not the same as causal relations there and then. So you've got enormous diversity, and if you do have that, then you will tend to get the sort of knowledge construction I'm talking about. Comes down to assumptions about the model that make empirical results tricky, spurious. You assume you're sampling from a single population, and your statistical results will be spurious in the technical sense. Empty. If you don't know how long the ruler is, or it's variable, then you'll tend to produce knowledge of a certain unreliable nature. Parameter estimation, in a sense, must assume that the model is true, etc. Push this closer to development, and one thinks about, one, the nature of the facts. This is one of the early chapters in the book. The use of aggregates, development, averages, that assume similarity and simplicity, gender, all these categories, as observables or aggregates, the averages. Take them down to a subgroup of countries, the same thing. They assume similarity and simplicity as a characteristic of what you're looking at, where the alternative is to assume diversity and complexity. And the rhetoric I pushed into this, you assume Barbie, which is the average of two heights of two girls, is real. Nothing wrong with that, but what happens if you do? Another thing to think about is the odd idea that development is linear, e.g. that there is strong, for example, that there is strong correlation between components of a composite development index, such as the HDI? I can't remember.
Development index?
Yeah. Or if they're strongly correlated, you only have to look at one. So what's happening? The facts that exist are interesting as facts. Social epistemologies, facts of a given social set of social epistemologies. And one can think, if one's thinking about organising on the basis of predictive power, is this theorised or not? And one of the things that seems to be the case amongst development practitioners is that they have, through trial and error, come to a rather strong and robust consensus about what works. That is, the development context is reasonably assumed to be low risk, though perhaps costly to engage with, but without actually knowing why. And this is the engineer in me, which is interested in prediction, not why. And that is interesting because you can find tensions between this sort of LORE law amongst practitioners and the social scientists, development studies people. We want to come in with theorised explanations. And it points to the point that prediction is different from theorisation. Practitioners are willing to assume predictive knowledge, but this is not theorised. How does this influence how they organise? Not much information available in the literature. And I think the simple reason for that is because the DAC-sponsored doctrine of the logical framework approach requires predictive knowledge. And it's easy to show from quotes that that is what is required. And anyone who's done any evaluations and got a TOR will know this. In other areas, where there are good reasons for asserting a need to organise to cope with high risk and extreme uncertainty, better policy and practice, the book argues, are helped by an examination and analysis of the origins of the ways in which policy designers and practitioners develop the theory of change that explicitly or implicitly underpins any application of the logical framework approach. So the book starts to try and then develops the argument that we can learn a lot, if you like, from the social epistemology of the origins of the ideas, expert knowledge, if you prefer that phrase, that term, that underpin the cause-effect metaphors that are required by an LFA. Where do these ideas come from? And of course, are they ideas that are tested predictively? The key research question is what, which the book tries to answer, or it does answer, whether you think it's a good answer or not, it's not up to me. What social epistemology underpins the LFA, which is the requirement that if interventions be based upon an assumption of predictive knowledge, that certain outcomes will knowably, ex ante and ex post, ex ante when you design it, ex post when you evaluate it, lead to certain outputs and outcomes. So I'm kind of taking a very large hammer and using it to hit at the foundations. Okay, this is big stuff. And what I'm not talking about here is that this is not just about development. It's about what I call policy government, evidentially based policy. Note that repeated evaluations of the same intervention do not typically converge, and there is good evidence that a blanket assumption, a required assumption, a doctrinally stated requirement of that assumption, as such knowledge being available, is reckless. Because obviously, sometimes we won't know. How much money are we willing to spend on quote knowing? Predictability. The book therefore discusses the issue of predictability and how it has been managed. This is in terms of procedures, scientific procedures. It does this by looking at implicit or explicit statements of procedures governing knowledge production to get some sort of handle on it. So it's coming at it procedurally rather than through sociology, asymmetries of power, critique, or those sort of things. And within the internet, a way into this is a quote I found in one of the most, it's now beyond that, it's been a new edition in IPE, International Political Economy literature. The question, what is globalization and how it should be conceptualized, in reply is a list of their particular criteria, which is a statement of the normative criteria that make a particular theory acceptable. Okay? So I treat this as a datum. Any satisfactory account of globalization has to offer, blah, 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 blah. And I think most people who work in development studies or social science would expect any theory or account that didn't meet these criteria that was presented in a seminar would be treated as a bad theory or account. So that's a statement of criteria. A robust specification of impacts, clear propositions about history for periodization, and some sound reflections about the trajectory of the process itself. Okay. So that's allowing me to start saying what one the characteristics of certain parts of the social epistemology are. What's interesting is the list is stated ex cathedra. It's not justified in any way. It's treated as totally normal, total common sense, totally commonplace. And I don't think, speaking as someone who writes papers and accounts of change in Vietnam, there's anything strange about this. So it's a useful statement one can then think about. This book, asserts the existence of two coexisting procedures, two coexisting things one can talk about as groups of criteria that describe what is acceptable within sciences. Basing the exposition upon Nisbet, the basis of Rist, you know the development studies literature, Frenchman, who compares this with Crombie, who focuses upon Grosser Tester, who's a man from the 13th century, who was the teacher of the first Bacon. So that's the origins of predictive science in terms of European history. This is, of course, a persuasive rather than a necessary argument. Nisbet's book goes back to the classical Greeks and forward to his time, the 1960s. He argues that much can be learnt from digging deep into history to elucidate and map how these common assumptions or beliefs have changed over time. What are the basic procedural rules, criteria, that are expressed, for example, in that quote from Heldetar? What are we talking about? Because one of the things about what Held is saying, and also comes up in Nisbet, is that it's a world of multiple truths, multiple theories. Held et al. Fit well within his statement of normative procedure for knowledge production. He argues that beliefs about social development have over time usually contained two distinct sets of ideas that are in mutual tension. Firstly, that social change is particular, contextual, and real. And secondly, which is what we're familiar with as social scientists, that social change is best treated through metaphor, through a discussion of the essential process of change. This is GDP, this is economic growth, this is development, which is essentially, for him, described as metaphorical. And therefore assumes ontological, epistemological stability for the particular theory. Nisbet argues that the metaphor is much more than adornments of thought and language. It's quite inseparable from some of the profoundest currents in Western thought on society and change. If you agree with them or not, well, you can read the book and then read his book. I think it's very persuasive, but I might be wrong. And he talks of natural histories, histories of the nature of things. The word more used nowadays is essentialist. The nature of development, the nature of power relations, the nature of gender, and so on. Expressed in those terms, which assume commonalities, applicability across widely different varying contexts. Accounts that are expressed in terms of the nature of social change and are deemed valid and contain with them cause, effect, logics. And in terms of the logical framework approach and theories of change, this means that theory is deemed to be valid, be a valid guide to action, requiring belief that discussion in terms of metaphor may map readily into discussions of action, of what to do and how things should be. What Nisbet illuminates for us is that this willingness to believe in the validity of a metaphorical account, or in a more modern language, a particular theory of development, willingness to believe in it, to use it as a basis for action, drives in part its use as a predictive guide to action. And then the void opens for me. Why believe this? And I go back to my engineering. Why build a bridge based on theory? Very dangerous thing to do. Just theory. In a different language, theory not tested in terms of its predictive validity is accepted as a valid basis for interventions that assume predictively known cause-effect relationships. I would say QED. But I've been moving fast, and this is from a book. Predictability. One of the interesting things about this discussion is how one then comes down to thinking about predictability. This can be most easily put as a ready belief in belief. And of course, it's very easy to show how if you're receiving aid, or if you're looking for work as a consultant, or if you're looking for work in aid agencies, belief is not stable. Varies between agencies, varies over time. And most of the standard textbooks on development simply exposit those. This is structural adjustment, this is. It's not stable over time. But for each particular here and now, it's treated as valid and as belief. Get a job for Oxfam and start talking about structural adjustment and you will be shown the door. It's not stable. That's what it is. That's the nature of the beast. Thus, Ford 2005 found that most citations of Levine and Zervos ignored their central point that there were almost no robust relations in that data set. Crombie finds that Grosseteste takes a development of the classic inductive-deductive iteration, which goes back to Aristotle, to require deductions to be tested predictively. Grosseteste himself, a believing Christian and a priest, thought that his theories, and it's all bound up with the relationship with the divine, had to be right, so he didn't test them. And they're actually not predictively valid. And this, as with Nisbet, Crombie, he treats as a procedural innovation. So what the book is focusing on procedure, the criteria of procedure, different sets of procedures, as we can take Nisbet as an expression of different procedural norms. And when I'm we're having a lunch, Terence and I are arguing. You kind of, if you're not careful, you label one as social science and the other as natural science. And that's a bit confusing. It makes it harder to get out of these boxes. This summary, and a lot of the book is about trying to talk about these sets of procedures, has some interesting implications. Firstly, viewing prediction as a criterion for the acceptability of a particular theory or account, rather than as a characteristic of a knowledge or theory. Does it predict or not? Most people think, does it predict? Well, does it predict or not? It's a characteristic of a theory that it can predict. And I say, well, if it predicts 51% of the time, is it predictive? And as an engineer, I say, well, it depends. Do you want the plane to fly safely or not? Right? And that then leads to the view that more interesting is to view prediction as a criterion where normative procedure contains a requirement with the procedure of the science that theories be compared and one selectable as the chosen truth for here and now. So it's a world that's not, in terms of its procedures, one of multiple truths. It tends to evolve in different ways and people fight over grants and so on. But its procedures are different. And that sense then says that if you don't have a criterion similar to that, that requires within the science that theories or accounts be compared constructively, destructively, then something outside the procedure will decide on the truth of the matter, the prince, the society, the donor, whatever, which I think is a very useful thing to know. You're not arguing, I'm not arguing with Terence because we're trying to find the truth. I'm arguing him because there are other people who would decide who's right. The apparently predictive knowledge, but not, that underpins the LFA and indeed mainstream ideas of policy generally is best seen as empirically founded theory. It's not separate from theory. Within an inductive process, evidence matters, but it matters in that way, not in terms of predictive comparison. With the particular truth adopted and or advocated here and now, therefore to be explained epistemologically, rather than through examination of the data or context. Or to shift my register slightly, if you want to know what the bastard consultants will recommend, ask who's paying them, and where they're coming from. TOR matters. An evaluation, for example, depends on the evaluators and their TOR, not all they're evaluating. Development doctrines vary over time and space. Those with recent masters are taught a range of them and choose agencies or fields bearing this in mind. Yes, I've been in the game a while. The logical framework approach, therefore, in that it requires a single theory of change. This makes sense to people? Theories of change, right? But one, as we say, asserts that any intervention have a single truth. And so those who disagree with this are wrong. This is a particular social epistemology. If I come across an aid project in Vietnam that has a theory of change, there's one. The other people disagree, like the local people or whatever. No, they're wrong. The relationship to competing theories is that they're wrong. Not that it's just a different way of looking at things. It's not Jane Austen. It's one way. It's a very interesting exercise, which I found. Well, it's not exercise, but it's compared to evaluations of two bridges across the Mekong, which I look at in the book and use quite a lot. One is in Laos, built by the Japanese assistants. The other is the Mitituat Bridge, which is down in the Mekong, which is Australian. And in terms of the rules that they follow, they're completely different, I think. The Japanese stress on reporting stakeholders' views. They bow towards the DAC, but then they say, we've talked to these people, it's different truths. And at the end, they sort of say, well, most people thought it was a good idea. And in my own evaluations, that's what I now do. And it's interesting, when the last one I did for the Swedes, the boss said, ah, good, it's a narrative account. And for their own politics, again, to shift register, if you do that, it means they're not going to be bitten the bum by somebody they forgot about. And most of the stakeholder groups, all your groups you talk to, think it's good. But then you look for the Australian one, and it's absolutely clear that they knew what really happened and why. And then when the argument took place, it was then a competing account of what really happened and why. And in terms of aid practice, I think the second one is extremely risky, unless you can control sources of information And the paper I did with Katrine Seidel on Cambodia, what bust that for the donors was the World Bank was involved and they had the complaints. What is it? Complaints system in the World Bank? If you, there's a World Bank project that's damaging you, you can complain. And the World Bank staff in Phnom Penh saw this as career-threatening. And they had Greens. German Greens were on the parliamentary committee in Berlin. And they had INGOs who in Cambodia are quite well-funded and close to foreigners, so that it fell to pieces.
So just as a point of clarification, when you're talking about, say, the difficulty of conducting evaluation and the different truths that are present, are you saying that there are multiple truths, multiple views, all which could be true, even when they are contradictory? Are you saying that there's no such thing as the truth? That is, I guess everyone is deluded and believing they know what's going on? Or are you saying that there probably is, there probably are some facts of the matter, some truths, but they're just very hard to find?
I'm saying that thinking in terms of truths makes one less effective. There's a quote at the start of the book by Hasluck, Australians will know who he was, saying that some people want to be social scientists, political scientists want to be right, politicians want to be effective. And I think framing these things in terms of truths and what you really believe in gets in the way. But let me finish. Okay, because that...
You've given me an answer anyhow.
Yeah, but whether it's satisfying or not, it's not up to me. The latter, the Australian evaluations, assumes predictive knowledge. That's what they get paid to articulate. But its science does not require testing for that. The former does not assume such knowledge, though it genuflects towards the DAC to which Japan belongs, and maps a series of natural histories in a Nisbetian manner. So this way of engaging with these things by looking at procedures and the different criteria with procedures for me is useful. It clarifies. And I summarise that by saying these are different social epistemologies, and I think the book elucidates how they differ. And the former is intellectually more consistent. But that's a matter of judgment. Implications. The book concludes that aid policy and practice both benefit from reconsidering theories of change in the LFA, and that this suggests that under high-risk situations, we should explore methods of devising policy and organising practice that allow for and make explicitly accountable, quote, sceptical approaches, giving some examples from other areas. And what I call a sceptical approach is an approach that assumes, for reasons to be discussed, that the context there and then is unpredictable. It's not a philosophical point, it's a statement about practice, and therefore expressed in organisation, just as the logical framework approach does exactly the same thing but goes in a different direction. That's what I mean by a sceptical approach. And I think a very powerful argument in grappling with this is that the DAC does not say you will assume predictability if you think it's a good idea, and you will assume unpredictability if you think it's a good idea. The DAC says you will assume predictability, so there's no right to scepticism, which I think is a very telling point. Hostility in principle to assertion of a right to scepticism comes down to an empirical assertion in a social context, right? Depends on the cost of getting data and all the rest of it, which is that predictive knowledge at reasonable cost is always available, which seems to me to be dangerous nonsense. You know, if you've got 5 million to work on a district, you're going to spend 4.5 million on baseline studies. You know, there has to be a choice. But yet it is powerful. Empirically, it's hard to find formal and informal documentation of processes that enjoy scepticism, which surprised me when I started writing the book. People, no. Informally, over beer or coffee, yeah. And there's an LORE, law about this, and how you Mickey Mouse the log frame, and what a sceptical change agent's manual would contain, but formal statements of it, much harder, because it's anathema. You're then unaccountable, you don't get the money, all the rest of it. It violates DSE doctrine, and so necessarily viewed as seeking to escape accountability. But if you make the point, which I think is a reasonable one, the context is sometimes better viewed as unpredictable, and from the data I was showing at the start, I think it very often is unpredictable, then LFA-managed interventions are better viewed as unaccountable anyway. And that's where it gets tricky. That's why I get burnt in effigy. Tick and flick, You remember that phrase? Collapse of authority, lack of trust, ill discipline. The way forward. Ah, yes. I brought my consultant's hat on. There is always a possibility to spend money productively. The book understands such sceptical approaches as ones that is in other areas formally assume the context as one of high risk and extreme uncertainty. That is, best assumed unpredictable. I put it in warning quotes because it's not an absolute statement. It's the outcome of some decision-making process, and so unsuited to the LFA. How might this be organised and be felt accountable? I answer these in the book speculatively, as we lack good ethnographic data on it. But I think if we were charming and tried harder, we'd found more. But I haven't been able to find very much. That's another point. The most interesting empirical evidence comes from the military, from the Prussian army and the Israeli Defense Force, who, as a matter of doctrine, which means what you teach people and they're meant to agree with, state that the context combat is chaotic and unpredictable, and they organize on that basis. The other side of this is that this thing, which seems to be a good idea because it's hard if you want to kill people in the Wehrmacht, you lot more than them on your side more get killed. They're very good at it. And the Israeli Defense Force is no slouch either. So other people have tried to implement it. And so there's information on that process. In the United States Firefighting Service, for example, which gets very interesting. The problems these encounter. The organizational glue of policy. There's this very good book, Shore and White, 1997, on the anthropology of policy, which treats policy as organizational glue, meaning establishment, meaning setting, and so on, ceases to be said to be evidentially based predictive knowledge, and ceases and shifts to be said to be winning, not the same. And the not the same needs to be underlined. Experience is that shifting from one to the other is really hard. So far as I can see, good accounts of systems that do this stress, one, the importance of openly, doctrinally, accepting that the environment can be said to be chaotic, and so interventions then not best planned as though expertly taught. There needs to be a statement that that is possible. Secondly, systems that manage to do this, the accounts of these stress, the broad and profound changes then required in what are called culture, power, interpersonal relations, and so on. Project officers, if they exist, do not platform on experts to tell the troops what will happen. Different things happen. And this requires very broad, very profound changes which people get very uncomfortable with. Leadership is about stating goals that lower levels can creatively act to arguably meet. The worst thing you can do is wait for orders. So there's a vision statement. We're trying to reduce poverty, da 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 da, and then the local projects fit in some way or other to that. And the in some way or other, and the status of accounts of the in some way or other is, of course, the million-dollar question. And we're not very familiar with it because we're not allowed to do it according to the DAC. And organizing to support this, in terms of what leadership does, not about managing how lower levels do so. And I remind you that I haven't been able to find good ethnographic accounts of how this might be done in aid work. Accounts often state that such changes took big efforts and fights against establishments. Third point is the need for efficiency and the ability to win against the odds. I was talking to someone in Hanoi about this, and they said, in areas, post-conflict areas, you'll find what you're saying much more receptive. They'll be much more receptive to this, because then it really matters, because you've got, when you talk to the embassy, you've got the defense people, the Americans, all the rest of it. It's not just normal aid work. Being accountable so skeptically. This is the black box. When I've got closer to, with INGOs and so on, singing this song, yes, but how will we be accountable? Even apart from the fact of results-based management and talking to the bilateral you're getting the money from requires this. If you can get your own money, what would you do? Not easy. But obviously, so much of human activity involves belief in unpredictability, quite normal. I find it very funny. Accounts stress such issues as the development of trust, familiarity, and support for creativity by practitioners, by troops. And I can talk more about this, but this is more speculative. Clearly, in areas of high risk where it's better to assume unpredictability, the accountability promised by the LFA is empty and destructive of respect and authority. That's been true for a while, I think. Most aid practitioners could probably make far more money in other careers, so that in practice there has to be parallel to DAC compliant accountability other structures. You can smell it if you go into a project. People care. Well, how? Who's trusted? Why? And as I said, I work in Vietnam, I work in Vietnamese, you can go around. And these issues of trust come in. Who's, you know, what's the informal? Do we trust these people? When you've got reports on stakeholders, was it real? And those sorts of things there. But as these are what could be called positive violations, getting at them is not easy. How I heard it said, does one Mickey Mouse the log frame? That came out of a consultant's mouth. Hard-working woman who had too much paperwork to cope with. What part of her practice was getting around it and doing things that she could live with. Implications for training. A sceptical change agent's manual. What would this probably suggest? If you look at the way Prussian Army, IDF, Israeli Defense Force organize, an awful lot of the training is on the job. You don't fly somebody in from Stockholm and give them a training, and tell them to give a training course on participatory methods. It's done on the job by people in the organization. How's that done? I'm not sure. But if reality is not assumed predictable, then much expert human capital, training, and in terms of the analysis that upon which the expertise that tells you what will happen, would be devalued. You're talking about massive shifts in the value of human, certain sorts of human capital. They know about the causes of gender imbalance, so they can be good advisors to change agents. Yo. Again, this is, if you're an expert on a country, unquote, like me, then this is, I remember there's a project in central Vietnam and had a major row between an expert who was Thai woman coming out of AIT, who's an expert on participatory methods. And no, the way the project was doing it was wrong because that's not what she'd been taught. Huh. Why does everyone have to come to the meetings when the husbands and the wives trust each other? Look, and you get that sort of stiffness. And then she goes and does something else with her life. If the key issue is how specific interventions can be done that contribute to the overall good, then training must involve development of relations between, for example, project staff, project managers, the desk, and those higher up in ways that work. It's a very different stance. These relations would no longer be those of the management of the construction, implementation, and evaluation of documents expressed in the LFA. As I said, I'm not doing too much on this because for me it's largely speculation. I don't know the ethnographics of it, and the practitioners, if they were let loose on this, would work out how to do it. In the Prussian Army, you were trained so that you could fill jobs two levels above your position as a matter of course, so that they understood each other. They weren't these experts up there. So the job of the staff in terms of vision setting is to set the overall vision, then go off, set it in motion and go away, have a cup of tea. This business of management of the process, coming down, how are your inputs relating to your output, how are you dispersing all that stuff? It gets in the way. It makes no sense makes no logical sense if the context is assumed chaotic, unquote. Now, if this runs, and here we are in Canberra, and we spend quite a lot of money on aid, then this is also the sort of stuff to work out. But it's very hard to work out because it's anathema. It's wrong. DAC says you must know what's happening and why. Okay, that's more or less a couple more points. What's the stance of the book? Why am I writing it? Why do I come at it in this way? The approach draws upon my development practice and origins of the natural sciences, we said to be quite conventional. I think it is. It's about trying to work out what are the defining criteria for things to be accepted as knowledge. It's about looking at empirics, things like that. It's not about critique or power asymmetry or whatever. Social production of knowledge, critique, I don't find that stuff very enlightening. And I don't think it's very helpful to practitioners. a very good book, I think, which shows this is Moss's book about a DFID project, which I think is a complete hoot. It's extremely funny, because he was paid a lot of money to push participatory methods into a particular part. He spends the first two chapters saying, oh, it's knowledge is just socially constructed, of course, you know, the project documentation defines who the stakeholders are. And then in chapter three or chapter four, you get the his whole particular sociological explanation, which says it's not like that at all, it's really like this, without explaining where he's coming from. And when he gets to the end, having jumped around and said that it's not a very good idea, where does it go? And DFID people did not like him, because simply saying that knowledge is socially constructed is not very helpful. I mean, it helps a bit, but it doesn't actually solve the problem. What do you do? In some sense, since we're social creatures, all our knowledges have to be socially constructed. Remember what I was saying about Grosseteste there, not bothering to test his predictions, because as a priest he thought it was divine revelation, so it had to be true, and so on and so forth. Focus on social epistemology in the book is rather like that of an empirical rather than a normative grammar of a language. What seem to be the rules in play? What are the facts used and how are they given meaning? I tend to ask how questions rather than why. Personally, what I found most interesting about writing the book was two things. Firstly, how I ended up treating prediction as a possible criterion. So prediction is then not, as I said, if you hit the target 51% of the time, is your theory predictive? Well, so it makes the point. It's much more interesting in terms of its presence or otherwise as a criterion. How it clarified that what was being done in the social production of knowledge, this is empirically based but not predictably tested theory, so something outside science decides on the truth of the matter. This is rather relaxing once one gets there. I find it relaxing. That's all it is. It's just theory. And finally, since humans like stories, well, that reminds me of a story. There's a very good book, The Irish in Australia, and Irish about 35%, the so-called Anglo-Saxon settlement. My family's Anglo-Irish. He's a Kiwi. Fortunately, in all this, when the logic is exhausted and the machinery of social analysis creaks to a halt, a refreshing core of irrationality and unpredictability remains. I love that. So, it's nice. Then I was working in Cambodia and had been sort of talking about these things. And one of my research assistants, who was an extremely clever man, very young, been to the Australian high school, said, so what do you personally mean by policy? Professor Ford required, well, you're a Buddhist, right? So you believe that we live in a world of illusion? Yes. Well, maybe think of it as some anthropologists do, as part of the beliefs used by people in a group, such as an aid agency, to organize what they do, rather than worrying too much about whether it is some true statement about reality. And he said, oh, and walked on. I think he's much cleverer than I am. And finally, a quote from Thomas Kuhn, which I put in a paper on servicization, because globally developing economies are not industrializing, they're servicizing. This is an anomaly treated by being ignored in the literature. I went through all the World Bank's World Development Reports, don't talk about it at all, almost not at all. If an anomaly is to evoke crisis, it must usually be more than just an anomaly. It's not about argument. So that's me. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter to get all the latest updates, or you can connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.